It's 6.5 minutes after 10 o'clock. Health experts tell us we need to eat more fish. We are eating more fish. The problem is that we're running out of wild fish, or at least the species most used for food. So what's the answer? Some say fish farms are the best way to solve the problem. Others are not so sure. And then there's the issue of genetically modified fish, the so-called frankenfish, about which it seems no one can be neutral. Good morning. John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. This hour, we'll talk about fish and how to best provide enough of them to satisfy the world's dietary needs. My guest is Brian Walsh, environmental columnist for Time Magazine. Brian Walsh, good morning. Welcome to the program.
Good morning.
Well, fish are the last wild game widely used for food around the world. I mean, we've farmed just about everything else. I guess you point out in your article, fish may be next. How much danger are we in of running out of wild fish?
Well, it's funny. I mean, that's an issue that fishery scientists are constantly arguing about, exactly how much is out there, exactly what's really sustainable. We know that the wild catch globally has kind of plateaued at about 90 million or so tons a year, really for the last decade or so. So it's hard to see it growing beyond that, and many people believe, especially environmentalists, think that we're actually fishing beyond that already, that essentially it's almost as if we have a bank account, and instead of taking off the interest, we're actually fishing into the principal, and if we continue at this rate, we will see fish really numbers start to decline significantly. So at the same time, you have consumption going up, so clearly something has to give, and it seems unlikely that you could get that done just with wild fish.
Which species are in the most trouble?
You tend to see the sort of the big predator species that tend to be in the most trouble. I mean, we've had fish like cod. These are fish that were once incredibly abundant around New England. There are old stories of early sailors coming in, and the fish were so thick they actually would jump onto the deck. Of course, it's long since gone from there. Bluefin tuna, big fish like that, are also declining and being fished beyond, I think, their sustainability. You know, you're seeing fish above that level. I mean, the higher up they tend to be in the food chain, the more problems you have. And also, if they tend to be the kind of fish that are on the global trade, so think of something like salmon. Think of something like, like sushi. If that kind of fish can be moved around the world, those are the ones that tend to be hit the worst.
We apologize for the technical issue here. The fancier we make the plumbing, the easier it is to stop the drains. Brian Walsh, can you hear me?
I can hear you, yes.
Okay, great. Well, let's start over again.
Okay.
According to the United Nations, this report that 32% of global fish stocks are overexploited. Are there some fish that are in more trouble than others?
Yes, I mean, you tend to see fish that are particularly popular, fish that are high in the food chain are particularly bad. We know, for instance, bluefin tuna, marlin, we've had cod in the past. These are all fish that seem to be far lower than their historical the wealth, where you once saw these fish were extremely common. Now there's very much a sense that they're declining very rapidly. It's obviously very hard to know exactly what's out there, and what's even more difficult is to know, you know, before real stats are being kept in about the middle of the last century, it's hard to know how abundant were these fish. But there's a real sense among a lot of fishery scientists that those fish in particular are on a path to really becoming quite rare.
So overfishing is said to be part of the problem. What are some of the other issues here? There's not just one reason why these fish stocks are depleted.
No, I mean, you know, overfishing is clearly one, but I mean, anything else you're doing to the oceans, I mean, if there's pollution, for instance, you may have agriculture runoff, you may have pollutant runoff going into coastal areas, that can really impact the health of waters, and that, of course, impacts the health of the fish that depend on them is one thing. You know, if you remove, say, lower fish on the food chain, say things like sardines, forage fish like that, that can actually have an impact on the entire marine food chain in a way that's very hard to predict. So basically, you know, we've treated the oceans as something that just gives us food for free. And as our demand goes up, as we can send out these gigantic factory fishing ships around the globe, we're just going to everywhere we haven't fished out yet, really sort of extending that fishing to those new areas. And at some point, it seems likely that we're going to literally run out of room. We're no longer going to be able to find new areas, new waters we haven't tapped before. And I think that's when fisheries scientists start to get worried about how sustainable over the long term. And I mean, decades in the future is the system, really.
All right. Well, let me put this out to our listeners, because I'm sure there'll be some people who have questions or comments to make about this issue. After I do that, then I want to actually start to talk a little bit about aquaculture. 800-486-8655 is the number to call to be on the program. 800-486-8655. Email address is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. You can also leave a comment on Facebook. Look for the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. My guest is Brian Walsh, environmental columnist for Time magazine. So fish farming has been around in some form or other for quite a few years, 4,000 going back to ancient China. But it's really only been in the last 20 years or so that that this has really started to be big business. And talk a little bit about this, where fish farming is taking place, who the big players are, and how it's worked so far.
Right. Well, as you point out, I mean, it's been done on land and in freshwater ponds for hundreds and thousands of years, really. I mean, going back to China, being the people who sort of really began this. But it's only, since the 60s, 70s or so that you see industrial farming for marine fish, the kind of fish we really like, salmon, fish of that nature. And, it's sort of all over the place. The biggest producers by far are actually in Asia. So you see, for instance, in Thailand, there are huge shrimp farms. If you're getting all-you-can-eat shrimp, $6 for a pound, what have you, you're probably getting a lot of that from farms in Asia, from farms in Thailand. China is actually the world's biggest producer altogether. They produce something like 61% of the world's aquaculture. And they most of it is for their own market, for things like carp that isn't terribly popular in the West, but they're actually also getting into exporting fish. They're getting into shrimp. They're getting into tilapia, which is something we'll probably come back to a bit later. And then, salmon is probably, in many ways, the poster fish for farmed fish. That's something, the Atlantic salmon is something we really did fish out in many ways. You don't see them in the wild very often anymore. But you see big farms in the west coast of Canada. You see major salmon farms in Norway, actually, where they're sort of the technological leaders on this. And also down in Chile, actually, there have been huge salmon farms, often farms that aren't the greatest in the world when it comes to sort of the ecological impact. So that's where you see it. The place where you don't really see it is the United States. The United States has a very small domestic aquaculture system. Really only about 5% of all the seafood we consume in the United States actually comes from U.S. aquaculture. In fact, altogether, something like 84% of our seafood is actually imported from overseas, from another country. So you don't see a whole lot here, although there is a movement in the government to begin to try to figure out a way if we can grow this industry, make us less dependent on foreign seafood.
Well, not sure exactly what the problem is this morning, but the gremlins seem to have gotten into the machinery. There are some environmental issues with salmon farming in Canada and Northern Europe. Disease among wild fish, releasing waste into coastal waters. Talk a little bit about some of the problems that fish farming has experienced.
Right. I mean, there are a number of problems. And really, it's sort of similar, I think, to the kind of problems you'd see in any concentrated agricultural system. I mean, they're similar to the problems you sometimes see with big farms on land in terms of, they will produce waste. You put 20,000, 30,000 fish in close proximity, they're producing a lot of waste. That in itself can be polluting for water. It can impact the quality of the water. It can impact the species around it. You mentioned something about disease, and that's a concern as well. Again, when you pack a lot of animals in closely, you're going to have a risk of disease spreading in a way that it wouldn't when they're out in the wild. And so what we sometimes see, for instance, with salmon is that since they're raised out actually in nets in the ocean, it's not uncommon for the farm fish to escape. And if they can escape, they can sometimes bring parasites, bring diseases, and then actually infect their wild cousins. I mean, sort of interact with them in a way that can be very dangerous for those wild species. And then lastly, there's an issue about what you're actually feeding them. Again, to take salmon as an example, these are carnivores. These fish do eat other fish in addition to some plants as well. And so if you need to actually fish sort of smaller fish to feed the farm fish, you know, you may actually not be doing yourself a favor in terms of the overall amount of fish in the oceans. I mean, you may actually have to take out more fish in the oceans, you know, to feed your farm fish than you're actually getting from the farm fish yourself. So that's kind of a net loss. So as long as that's the case, those are all concerns that people have about how sustainable it is to ramp this up over the long term if you can't deal with these problems.
Let's take a break, and when we come back, we'll go to the phones and we'll take a call. We're talking about fish farming. Hopefully, we'll be able to stay on for the rest of the hour. We get our technical house in order here. And wondering what you think. A line is available for you right now, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The address, talk@WPR.org. If you want to send an email, talk@WPR.org. And you can also leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. 21 minutes after 10 o'clock, coming up later on today on the Ideas Network. No deal on the debt, yet President Obama is optimistic. John Boehner isn't laughing, saying it's time for Democrats to get serious. After one on Talk of the Nation, political junkie Ken Rudin joins host Neil Conan for a look at the week in politics. That's coming up later today on the Ideas Network. This hour we're talking about the problem of, we don't have enough fish to feed everybody who wants to eat fish. Fish farming is an alternative. We're looking at that. And my guest is Brian Walsh, environmental columnist for Time Magazine. We have callers who want to join us. We'll start in Hebron, Illinois with Phil. Phil, good morning.
Good morning, gentlemen. I have two quick questions for you. I read an entry on the internet, I believe it was on a scientific website, that a major breakthrough had been made in captive breeding of bluefin tuna. And my other question is, I make a real mean calamari, and I have an old fisherman friend who always says, we're fishing down the food chain. You call it dinner. I used to call it bait.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the bluefin tuna. I heard about that. I know that there is a company in Australia that's been working on that's figuring out a way to actually raise these fish. And I don't know if you've ever seen a bluefin tuna. These are huge fish. I mean, in some ways, they're incredibly fast. They swim across the entire ocean. They're a bit like the tigers of the sea, is the way they're sometimes compared. And so ranching them is proven to be challenging. But they are getting a little bit closer. But the concern there is with bluefin tuna, while they're incredibly popular, I mean, they go for thousands and thousands of dollars at sushi markets in Japan. They also require a lot of feed. You need, I think I've heard something like on more than 20 pounds of feed to raise 1 pound of bluefin tuna. So, you know, we were talking about the sustainability of this over the long term. That may not be all that sustainable. You know, it works as a luxury fish, but I would have to wonder how sustainable that would be over the long term. And I guess the other issue, you know, talking about fishing down the food chain is a very, very good point. You know, once, you know, to take something like fish and chips, you know, used to be, you know, years ago, that was always codfish. That was what would be in your fish and chips. Basically, as the cod disappeared, you started to find other ones, started to find white fish like haddock and going down to rake. I mean, you keep looking further and further down, trying to figure out something that in the past you wouldn't have bothered to eat, but now we don't have much choice. And, of course, that you can only do that for so long before you really do begin to essentially start scraping the bottom of the food chain.
All right. Thanks for the call. Let's go next to Sarah in Trempealeau County.
Hi there.
Sarah.
I also had a – can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Okay. I have a couple quick questions as well. One is more solution-focused. As an individual, what are a couple things we can do to kind of help this issue as a consumer? A couple tips. And then also, if there's been any evidence to show that the rise in utilizing fish oil supplements for health reasons has created anything that's been hurting the ocean system as well.
Sure. Those are two really great questions. I mean, in terms of what you can do as an individual, you know, one way actually is to eat seafood that is a bit lower on the food chain. We're talking about fishing down the food chain, but if you're talking about things like oysters, mussels, anything that's sort of lower on the aquatic food chain, actually, they tend to be more sustainable over the long term, sardines, things like that. Not the most popular fish out there, but they actually can be very, very healthy for you. And because, in part because they're not as popular, they haven't been out, as outfished, but also they grow back very quickly. You know, they are, if you're talking about mussels and others, they're actually filter feeders, so they actually help reduce pollution in the water. So that's one key easy way to do it, you know, as opposed to things like shrimp or really high in the food chain, go low in the lower on the marine food chain. And in terms of in terms of the other question, I think about sorry, what was the other question? I missed that one.
Supplements. The rise in utilizing those for health reasons is a problem.
Right. Official, yeah. I mean, that is very much a concern. So, you know, to feed farm fish, for instance, we have been taking forage fish lower on the food chain to feed them, and fish oil is a very important part of that diet. One of the things we really like about seafood is the fact that it has things like omega-3 oils, and for the farm fish to get that, you need to include fish oils in their diet. So there's obviously a competition between supplements taking up some of that fish oil, between somebody going to farm fish, and, of course, just within the environment altogether. Right now, that's not a huge concern, I think. Like, if it continues to grow, I think it will become a bigger issue. The healthiest way, my understanding at least, is to try to get those kind of oils from your diet versus supplements. So I think that's kind of what you should go for. But, you know, if you see this trend towards supplements really start to grow outside the U.S. and go to other countries, then I could see a situation where that could really begin to put pressure on those supplies.
All right, Sarah, thanks for that call. Let's see, 800-486-8655. Lines are available for you if you'd like to get in on this topic. 800-486-8655. Talk at WPR.org is the email address. You can also leave a comment on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page wall, and we'll take a look at it and share it on the air. One of the issues with farm fish as opposed to wild fish is they at least sometimes don't have the same kind of nutritional value, same kinds of omega-3 fatty acids, that kind of thing, as wild fish. Is that the case?
It can be sometimes the case. I mean, it's hard to make blanket statements because, you know, it often depends on how they're raised. And of course, it also depends on what kind of fish they're raised. I had mentioned, I think, tilapia a bit earlier in the conversation. Tilapia, which originally the Nile perch, are this fish that suddenly have exploded in terms of the amount of production they're doing. They're incredibly easy to raise in fish farming. For one thing, they're vegetarians, which means you don't have to feed them other fish. You can feed them soy, you can feed them corn, even you can feed them algae. And they just also grow very easily, which is very important. You can put them in ponds, you can put them fairly densely, and you can grow them all around the world. So they're being grown in Asia, they're being grown in the U.S., they're being grown in Latin America and Africa, places like that. So that's good, but the problem is these fish actually don't have very high levels of omega-3s, in part because they are vegetarian. So, you know, if your big concern is those omega-3s, if you're worried about that heart-healthy aspect, you know, a tilapia is not going to do it the same way that a salmon would. And by the same token, we tend to see wild fish tend, you know, somewhat to have higher levels of those kind of nutritional values. And again, I think you know, we shouldn't go and say that, you know, we should all stop eating, wild caught fish. I mean, there still are a lot of fish out there that can be caught right. And there are also areas around the world where fishermen are doing it right. One example actually is with salmon in Alaska, where you have a fairly sustainable managed fishery. They know how much they can take, how much they can't take to ensure that there will be fish next year. You know, and those are in some ways the highest quality salmon you can find. Of course, they're also a lot more expensive. So, you know, when we think about the future of fish farming, it often comes down to figuring out how do we get fish out there at a rate that's actually affordable for everyone, not just in the United States, but thinking about the other parts of the world as well. So, you know, if you can afford these kind of wild-caught fish, it's often better. But, you know, at the same time, you know, if we just want to get as many fish out there as possible, fish farming is an important way to do that.
I said we'd come back to this. You say there isn't very much aquaculture in the United States. What is the reason for that? Why hasn't it caught on here as it has in other countries?
Well, for one thing, it's often hard to do from a permitting kind of perspective. Until fairly recently, actually, there has been not much in the way of a national policy on aquaculture, kind of a national guidance support for the industry. So that's one thing. You see on the sort of local level, you often see some of opposition, I think, to aquaculture, and that's in part because we've seen areas that once supported fishing have gotten much more into tourism. I mean, to take an example, you can look at the New England coast, places like Maine and Massachusetts. 50 years ago, you know, those were coasts that were mostly used for fishing. They were working coasts. Now they've really translated it into something that's often much more for tourism. You see people getting summer houses there, you know, spending quite a lot of money to do that. And if you're going to spend all that much money for a summer house, you're not necessarily going to be wanting to be looking at, say, an aquaculture farm or that kind of operation. So you see a lot of local opposition to it, and that sort of keeps it from happening. And then, you know, often I think you can also get producers undercut by foreign producers. So U.S. producers are actually, they can't often compete on a price basis with, say, farmers in Chile or farmers in Asia who are able to use lower costs. And then, therefore, sort of get their fish in there into the U.S. market at a much more reasonable price than what U.S. producers can do. So you put that together again, it makes it very hard from talking to farmers here in the U.S. to really get off the ground to really grow in any meaningful way.
I know that there is aquaculture in Wisconsin. It has been being developed over the last 15, 20 years. Are there certain areas of the country where there's more of it going on than others?
Mm-hmm. If you're talking about on land, I mean, things like catfish have been raised in the South for quite a long time, those kind of freshwater fish. You know, and there's also sort of smaller scale aquaculture, often just for the sake of restocking wild ponds, wild lakes for sport fishing as much as anything else. In terms of sort of the biggest industry, I think Maine is sort of where you see most of it. They have a fairly growing and vibrant lobster farming, mussel and oyster farming. They're getting into salmon farming as well, although they're much smaller than say the Canadians across the border. So that's kind of where it's really happening. You know, the government is getting interested in trying to open up, say, the Gulf Coast to that kind of farming. Right now, there's very little to none done. And then there's actually even sort of people who are thinking about other kinds of farming in a state like Hawaii, where you would actually be able to raise fish a bit further out away from the coast in these open ocean nets that are quite interesting, with the idea that you could get maybe even bluefin tuna one of these days. And it would be far enough away from the coastline that if there's any pollution, it would sort of dissipate before it gets there. So that's kind of more along on the horizon, but that's the direction producers are looking at right now.
All right, let's go back to the phones. This time it'll be Tim in Fort Collins, Colorado. Tim, good morning.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Go ahead.
Okay. I'd like to make a very short comment and then ask your guest a question. And the short comment is just that I've been following the existence of fish farming for seafood for quite some time and have read all sorts of books, of which Four Fish is my favorite. And I just am thoroughly disgusted by the state of affairs for the consumption of seafood and freshwater fish. I mean, people that think that tilapia is a fish that's palatable is just, to me, unbelievable. But my question is I have saw a recent lecture by a researcher by the name of Dr. Ian Lipkin, and he's been featured in New Yorker magazine as the quote-unquote virus hunter. And in this lecture, a small part of it was he was just talking about hunting for microbes, and he talked about a project he did where he looked at salmon that have been disappeared in the north coast of Scotland and over to Norway, et cetera, Greenland. And they started looking at it, and they found a virus that had escaped from fish farms. Is your guest aware of that?
So the question is, am I aware that spreads?
Yeah, and the work that he's done.
Yeah, I mean, I know about Dr. Lipkin, and I know that is a risk. I mean, I wasn't aware that there's, is that a human virus that they were concerned about, or?
Oh, it's a fish farm salmon virus that jumped to the wild salmon.
Oh, yeah, I mean, that's absolutely, I think I even remember that study. I mean, that is a serious risk, because you have a situation where these are animals that are not accustomed to being farmed, that's where diseases spread. I mean, just like think about people in a city, think of the density you have of people in a city, think of what happens when you have flu season there, the way it spreads. Now, you know, those fish can start spreading those diseases one to the other. We see it with animals on land as well. The difference is here, they can get out, they can escape. If you don't have the right kind of surveillance, you don't have the right kind of security on an aquaculture, on a farm, they get out there to the wild animals, and suddenly a disease that had been more or less confined to a fish farm suddenly gets out into the wild. I mean, that's a huge concern. I mean, that's something that producers struggle with and something that regulators really have to worry about as well, you know, because that's something that can have a serious impact on wild fish. And we were already talking about what the impact of just fishing is doing to these populations. You throw in something like disease, you're making it doubly difficult for them. And just to go back to the other thing you mentioned about tilapia, I mean, it's funny. Chefs agree with you. I mean, many people think that tilapia is kind of an unpalatable fish, you know, and that's a very good question. I mean, how should we be treating seafood? Should it be something that we only eat very occasionally? I mean, that's one argument to go about doing it, that we don't eat it as often. I mean, the truth is with Americans, we eat, I think, on average about 3.5 ounces of seafood a week, which isn't a great deal. I mean, some of us obviously eat a lot more. But at the same time, we have the government telling us we should be closer to 8 ounces a week, you know, for heart reasons and others. You know, so we're well below what we're supposed to be eating according to our very own dietary guidelines. So we have an issue here. I mean, is that realistic? Can we have enough fish out there to actually meet those? And if that's not the case, we should be thinking maybe about, we should be rethinking about what place that seafood should have in our diet.
Tim, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Robert in Plymouth. Robert, good morning.
Good morning. I just have a little comment on this, the whole fish situation. I actually feel sorry for the fish because it's to the technology that we have these days that they don't have a chance. I mean, all these graphs and this equipment, and it's kind of like when the white man came after the buffalo and the buffalo couldn't survive. And if they don't regulate the fishing, fish can't compete with human technology. And I guess that's all I got to say. It's just not fair for the fish.
Yeah, that's very true. I mean, if you've ever, I don't know if anyone's ever seen, you know, the really big industrial fishing fleets you get out there. I mean, these are huge, huge operations. Obviously, they can take advantage of radar, things like that, sonar, things that were never possible for fishermen in the past. And also, what's not as well known is that you often have these fishing fleets are subsidized by the government, not necessarily the U.S. government, but if you're talking about fleets in Japan, fleets in China, fleets from European countries, it would be very hard for them actually to work economically if they had to pay the full load. But they often get subsidies in terms of fuel, which enables them to go, you know, stay out to the water much longer. So it's not a fair fight at all, and it's not realistic to think that, you know, if we just take advantage of this and, you know, and just fish as much as we can, it's not realistic to think that there won't be serious impacts in the long run to be felt very soon.
Well, but the bottom line is, I mean, that's true, okay? But as you pointed out, we're told we need to eat more fish. As the world's population continues to expand, there'll be a lot more people eating more fish. And so if we restrict the way we can catch them, I guess the bottom line is, and I think you made this point earlier, is that no matter what we do, there just aren't enough fish in the ocean to satisfy our demand for that type of food.
I think that's accurate to say. And so, you know, I mean, that's where you think about how do we make farming better? You know, I mean, it's probably not realistic given current demand levels. To say that we shouldn't be doing farming at all. Rather, and even environmentalists are now sort of coming to this perspective, let's figure out a way to do it better, to do it in a way that's less destructive on the environment, that produces less of a risk of disease spreading, that puts less stress on the oceans in a broader way. I mean, I write about a fish that's being raised now called barramundi, which you may not have heard of. It's only raised in fairly small amounts. It's actually from Southeast Asia and from Australia. And what these fish farmers I've met in the U.S. who raise it here have discovered is this is a very, you know, as farmed fish go, this one works pretty well. For one thing, it's very healthy. It does have very high levels of omega-3s, unlike fish like tilapia. I can tell you it tastes pretty good. It has kind of a sea bass kind of taste. And also, I mean, it requires some forage fish to be fed, but it produces much more fish in terms of, you know, fish to market than it requires as an input. And that's a positive. You need to have a positive, so you're getting more than you're putting in. And put that together, it makes for a fish that's very efficient to be farmed. So if we look around and look beyond things like tuna, things like salmon that we're just accustomed to eating, try to find other fish out there that might respond better to aquaculture, we may find that there's a much better way to do this, and we may be able to sort of meet that demand in a way that doesn't, you know, wreck the oceans along with it.
Well, and I was going to make this comment earlier. I want to get it before I lose it. One of the things that people don't understand about fish in the wild is that in spite of the fact that a fish may produce thousands of eggs, very few of those eggs actually end up becoming fish. I mean, fish don't reproduce the way a lot of people assume they do.
Right. That is often the case. I mean, just because they produce an amazing amount of eggs is by no means that they're actually going to come back that quickly. And other fish take a while to get to maturity. It often tends to be that the higher up you are on the food chain, the longer it will take for you to get there. So if you end up, say, again, taking a whole generation, imagine, of cod, for example, out of the oceans, it takes a lot of time for those to be replaced. You know, I mean, it's not something that's going to happen overnight. So that's something you really have to keep in mind, that the system is sensitive to those kind of changes.
All right. Let's take a break. And when we come back, we've got another phone caller. There are lines available for you if you want to get in on this topic. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. And you can also get on the Kathleen Dunn Facebook fan page and make a comment there. We do want to, one of the threads I don't want to lose in this conversation is genetically modified fish and the role that they're going to play going forward. So we'll be sure to get to that. And that certainly would be fair game for calls and emails and Facebook comments as well. I'm John Munson in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of WPR. It's 10:43. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Here's what's coming up. After 11, Larry Miller welcomes entomologist Phil Pelletieri to talk about the fascinating world of insects. Japanese beetles and mosquitoes have definitely arrived. What other insects are particularly active now? You'll get an answer to that question after 11. Fish on our minds this hour, and my guest, Brian Walsh, environmental columnist for Time Magazine. We have a Facebook comment I wanted to share, and because it speaks to something we talked about a little bit earlier. Sue writes, "Goodness, the political red tape involved with aquaculture is horrible. You can haul nuclear waste easier than you can farm fish."
Yeah, that's. I'm not sure if that's exactly true. At least I certainly hope it's not. But that's absolutely true. I mean, in terms of what I've heard from producers, there's just a frustration that, you know, there are so many rules you have to get through, that there's no simplicity to it, that you're dealing often with, say, local issues. You're dealing with local permits, then maybe you're in the state permits, and then, you know, there's nothing on national to do something like that. So, I mean, it really, you know, if there was a real desire, I think, on the part of the country to say, we want to make sure that most of the seafood that we eat is actually from America, you know, we could do that, but it just doesn't seem as if that's something that's a very high priority for the country right now.
All right, let's see. Let's take another call. We'll go to Blooming Grove and talk to Ron. Ron, good morning.
Thanks. There is a partial solution to these related problems, and that is for humans to eat the invasive species of fish, which are causing problems in the environment. Our classic example here in the Midwest is a couple of species of carp imported from Asia, the silver carp and the bighead carp, which were raised in aquaculture down in Dixie, and then when floods came and overtopped the levees of their fish ponds, they got into the Mississippi River system. In the last few years, there's been a big federal case fight over whether to shut down the canals in Chicagoland to prevent these carp from getting into the Great Lake and decimating the native species there. So a partial solution is for people who like to eat fish to get out there and catch the carp and to can them or smoke them or pickle them or whatever suits their palate, but to eat the carp that are crowding out the other species of fish that naturally live here in the Midwest and in the Great Lakes. Related to that, later this year there is scheduled a new Wisconsin cookbook, and it includes at least one recipe for carp.
All right, Ron, thanks for the call.
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, I've actually written about the invasive Asian carp before. I've actually been out to Illinois to cover an event once where people were actually hunting those fish. That's exactly what they were doing. And that's a great idea. I mean, that's something that could definitely happen. There is a lot of carp out there. And if it gets into the Great Lakes, I mean, you could have a lot more. And, you know, carp is not something that's actually very often eaten in America, but it's incredibly popular in Asia and China. I mean, in China, they've been raising carp for thousands of years, and they love it. I mean, I've had it before. I mean, one of the problems, I think, often for people in the U.S. to eat it is that it tends to be very bony, very hard to fillet. So it's the kind of thing that maybe sometimes is easier to eat with chopsticks. But definitely, you know, there's fish out there, and that's the kind of thinking we have to do. It's like if we want to maintain seafood, if we want to maintain that sort of diet, let's get more creative with the kind of seafood we're eating. Let's not just eat the same two or three fish and think about what else is out there. And I think we might find things that we actually like.
All right, Ron, thanks for the call. Let's see. Let's go to Dave in McKinley Park, Illinois. Dave, good morning.
Yeah, hi, guys. Hey, what I was saying is these depleting the fish in their supplies, why don't they restrict them when they're, you know, until they're finished spawning? So to let these fish spawn out, and then, you know, maybe we'll have a bigger supply of fish.
Yeah, I mean, that's a basic principle of fishery management is to sort of make sure that they have to be a certain size before you can take them. Anyone who's a sports fisher knows, of course, you know, there's limits on that, and they do take that very seriously. The problem really with fishing is that, of course, so much of it happens outside the control of any one country. You know, once you get beyond one country's coastal waters, you get into open waters, that's in many ways, you know, sort of a open season in some ways on those kind of fish. It's not something that, where there's a lot of management. It's not something where there's any wildlife cop who's going to come out there and make sure, you know, you're doing the right thing. So that's a real problem we have. It's sort of a global commons, and so there's an inclination on any part of any fisherman or the part of any country just take as much as they can get because they don't want to be shut out of that later. So that's where we need, I think, a better international system to really think about, well, what are the sustainable levels of fisheries, what's not sustainable, and figure out a way to actually enforce that.
Well, again, I mean, if we reduce what we take out of the ocean, we've got to replace that somewhere, and so we keep coming back to the same thing. No matter what we do, there just aren't enough. There aren't enough fish. One of the things that you touched on this just a little bit earlier, but I want to make sure that we really take a good look at this before we run out of time here, and that is the role of genetically modified fish in this whole discussion. You've written about that. You've done some research on it. Talk about how big a role going forward genetically modified fish are going to play, and what are some of the pluses and minuses there?
Absolutely. I mean, this is a very interesting subject. So what you have is there's a company out of Massachusetts called Aqua Bounty that has developed a genetically modified farmed salmon. And so what they do is they take an Atlantic salmon, which is the most popular farm version of that, and they actually splice in a gene from a Chinook salmon, another sort of cousin of it from the wild that tends to be bigger, swims farther in the north. And what they've discovered is that enables the GM salmon, the genetically modified salmon, to grow, they say, about twice as fast as a conventional farm salmon. So you can imagine, I mean, anyone who's a farmer would know that if you can get an animal to grow that much faster, you can get them to market that much faster. That really reduces your costs, and you can get more fish out of what you're actually doing. Now, this is not approved by the FDA yet. Right now, it's been looked at for a while. They had some hearings about almost a year ago, and it's kind of under review right now. Clearly, a lot of environmental groups are very worried about this. This would be the first genetically modified food animal to ever be approved if it does go forward. Obviously, we have lots of genetically modified crops. This would be the first time we actually have a food animal that we actually be eating. And the concerns are, you know, there are worries that if this modified fish gets out, if it escapes the way that farm fish sometimes do, it could pollute the gene pool of wild salmon. That's one concern. People worry about allergies. And I think a lot of people just worry about, they're just, you know, to be totally honest, just creeped out by it. They find the idea of eating a species that's been modified genetically to be strange and unnatural. Even though, of course, you know, we breed naturally farm fish, we breed farmed animals all the time. But the idea of using genetic engineering, I think, really worries people a lot. So it's not very clear at this point whether this is actually going to go forward or not.
Is this we're talking about the United States? Is this happening in other countries?
It's not happening in other countries. I mean, this particular fish is the furthest along, definitely. Although there are other, I know there's a genetically modified trout that scientists are working on. There's a lot of potential out there beyond fish. There's a genetically modified pig, actually, that there are researchers in Canada who are working on that produces less waste, is more efficient in terms of the way it uses feed. But I would not be surprised that if you, for instance, saw the U.S. say no to this, to government regulators say that they're not going to approve this, you wouldn't necessarily see this kind of technology popping up in other countries, especially in Asia. You know, a country like China, where I think obviously the public concern level might be different in terms of GM, and certainly the government control over that system is very different. They might be someone that would say, yes, we'll go for this technology, we'll accept it, we'll look, because we want to produce, we have a huge demand going forward. We have people who are making more and more money who want to vary their diet. So that's where you could see this kind of technology going if it doesn't actually start with the United States.
All right. We'll go to Dubuque, Iowa next and hear what Joe has to say. Joe, what's on your mind? Joe, go ahead. Can you hear me?
Okay, it's very hard to hear you. A very brief question for your guest, and I don't know if you could handle this, but a lot of us are concerned about the amount of pollutants, and in particular mercury, in the diet, such that I don't eat it, and I don't give it to my pets, and that kind of thing. I wonder if the guest could possibly comment on that.
You're talking about mercury is definitely a concern for seafood more broadly, and just so we understand how that works, what actually happens often is that you have mercury in, say, coal, for instance. It's burned for power. That gets into the atmosphere, then eventually makes its way down into the marine environment, and then makes its way up the food chain and gets into fish, and that's how it often gets into us. That is definitely a concern, especially for very young children, because there are neurological issues to worry about, especially for pregnant women as well. There are concerns there in terms of how that might pass on to their children. The ways to avoid this, if you eat, I talked about earlier about eating low in the food chain. It's fish like tuna that tend to have, especially canned white tuna, tends to have the highest levels of this because, again, they're high in the food chain, so they're eating. You can imagine that the mercury gets concentrated as it makes its way up to them. But again, if you look to eat lower on the food chain, things like, again, mussels, clams, things like that, you won't have the same kind of issue with those kind of toxins. My understanding, I think, is that if you're looking at, say, wild fish out from parts of Alaska, places like that, you won't have the same kind of mercury problems. But this is going to remain a serious issue. As long as we're still sort of emitting mercury into the atmosphere, as long as there's very few limits on that kind of pollutant, this will be a problem in the food chain. It's definitely something to be concerned about.
Joe, thanks. Thanks so much for that call. We let's go to Ingleside, Illinois, and hear what Charles has to say. Charles, good morning.
Good morning. I wonder if I were to set up a fish farm in my property. Will I get any income tax, any property tax abatement?
I'll be honest. I'm not sure about that in that level of detail. I guess I would assume so, but that's something I guess probably ask a tax lawyer about.
Yeah, there may be some property tax incentives at some point for this, but it doesn't sound like there's a real big push to make aquaculture a centerpiece of our agricultural effort in the U.S.
Right,
so
absolutely.
You know, until there's some real push or some real demand for that, hard to see the politicians handing out any more tax breaks. Okay, let's see. The conundrum we have here, and we've said this before this hour, but we're getting to the end of the program, and I'd kind of like to try to maybe wrap things up a little bit or summarize, kind of get to where we're take a look forward and see where we need to go. We have more people in the world. We're all supposed to be eating more fish. Now, I have to say that I'm doing my part to save the fish population because if it swims for a living, I don't eat it. But a lot of people are eating more fish. There are many places in the world where fish is the main meat item on the diet. We're going to need more fish. We're going to have to figure out a way to do this fish farming thing and do it right. Is there Is there any kind of consensus developing on how fish farming ought to go forward? Some commonality on environmental regulations and things like that, so that we can do this in a safe manner, not cause more problems. I guess one of the things I learned first in my old environmental science class as an undergraduate is that when it comes to the environment, you can never do just one thing. Whatever you do affects something else. Okay, is there some consensus developing on how we solve that problem when it comes to aquaculture?
There you are getting some consensus beginning to develop. You have big environmental groups like the World Wildlife Fund actually are now working with industry to develop standards for the way this is done. One of the problems is, of course, this industry is so scattered around the world, so many different countries, so many different regulations. It's not something there's often been sort of a commonality, you know, a common code of conduct. So what they're hopefully developing is fish by fish, you know, starting with things like shrimp, tilapia, going to salmon eventually, other kinds of fish that are very popular for farming. Figure out these are the standards you need to meet if you want to be able to, say, put a certificate on your packaging. So you and I as consumers would know, okay, this producer meets those kind of standards, this producer has not, does not, and that would begin to give us a better sense as consumers to be able to use our power in terms of what we're actually buying and eating to support those who are doing it right. It's a long process because this is a fairly new industry, and we are trying to figure out all those aspects of it. As you mentioned, you can't just do one thing, so you have to think about, well, you know, if we start changing one aspect of production, how will that influence other aspects and make sure that you're not inadvertently making things worse along the way. But I do think, you know, we're getting there. You know, we're beginning to improve it. The challenge is really going to be, like it is with everything else now with the food system, is kind of making sure you stay ahead of that demand that keeps going up and up with population, and make sure that you can meet that, because that's, you know, for fish, for vegetables, for grains, for other meats, it's going to be very challenging going forward to meet that. So, in, you know, by 2020, 2030, 2040, 2050, there's enough food out there for the entire planet.
Well, the UN says we need to increase global food production by 100% by 2050. So we're going to have to act quickly if we want to do that. Brian Walsh, thank you for spending this hour. It's been technically challenging, but very informative. Thank you for being patient.
Great. Thank you very much.
Brian Walsh is the environmental columnist for Time Magazine, and thank him for his participation this hour. This program was produced by Chrissy Pease, who also handled on-air production. If you'd like to hear this program again, if you missed part of it, you can go to our website, WPR.org, and listen to it once again. Go to the Kathleen Dunn page at WPR.org, and the program should be there later today. I'm John Munson, in for Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.